So thank you all for joining us today. I'm excited to hear more about the UK's National Security Council and their intelligence failures. Today we have Celia Parker presenting for us today. Celia has worked as an intelligence analyst at the UK's Foreign and Commonwealth Office. Since leaving, she's been teaching intelligence analysis across the globe. She's completed her master's in intelligence and security at the University of Leicester this year and has started working towards her doctoral degree at King's College in London. For her doctoral degree, she's looking at the leadership of the UK's intelligence community. And so with that, Celia, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to you, and I'm looking forward to learning all about this.
Thanks, Nicole, and good morning / good afternoon, everyone. As Nicole said, I've just started my PhD at King's College, and my area of interest is really leadership of intelligence matters, so central leadership. So my thesis is going to be on leadership of the intelligence community centrally, and always in the backdrop of that is looking at intelligence failures, intelligence politicization, and how we can improve the system. So today I want to talk to you about the creation and the impact of the creation of the UK's National Security Council, and particularly the impact on the vulnerability of the UK system to intelligence failures. So the central question of the presentation is, has the creation of the National Security Council in the UK reduced the likelihood of intelligence failures at the hands of executive consumers in the UK? By executive consumers, I mean the Prime Minister and senior cabinet ministers. So first of all, let's take a look at why, what the National Security Council is. So the National Security Council in the UK was created by David Cameron's Conservative Liberal Democrat coalition government in 2010, so nearly 10 years ago now. Its creation was more evolutionary than revolutionary. It's probably wise to say that it was another attempt by a British Prime Minister to improve strategic and operational planning on national security and prosperity rather than something brand new. It just was another attempt through a string of attempts over the years. So what is the NSC? It's the primary forum for discussing the UK government's national security objectives. It's chaired by the Prime Minister. More than intelligence is used to make decisions within the NSC, but intelligence plays a vital role there, and the heads of the agencies, i.e. MI5, MI6 and GCHQ, attend all its meetings, and so does the chairman of the Joint Intelligence Committee. As recently explained by the chief of MI6, SIS Alex Younger, on a podcast, at the NSC, he doesn't just represent his service or represent intelligence products, but he also provides his expert opinions in a type of, I suppose, consultancy. The NSC sits at the heart of the Whitehall intelligence and security world and drives the UK intelligence community's work, offering an unparalleled interaction between intelligence and policy. This is really symptomatic of the growing centrality of intelligence over the past decades in the UK, which is something that we'll talk about a little later on. So the NSC brings together cabinet ministers into the heart of national security policymaking and gives them access to sensitive intelligence. Over the years, of course, cabinet members and executive members of UK leadership have always had access to intelligence, but it hasn't been in such a formal way. At the NSC, intelligence is used across a wide range of issues, from strategic subjects, for example, the advance of states like China, to military engagements, such as under the NSC, the intervention in Libya in 2011. Certain commentators, for example, Katerina Thompson, David Blagden as well, have argued that the NSC's creation and the accompanying reforms around it, because the NSC was created amongst a number of security sector reforms in 2010, constituted a major overhaul of national security decision making in the UK. But I assess that actually it wasn't a major overhaul. It was just bringing together lots of other ideas and making improvements. For example, its inspiration can be traced back as far as the first half of the 20th century, in the form of the British Committee of Imperial Defence, which was an institution tasked with researching and coordinating military strategy. Developments in the form of support for the UK executive with regards to national security continued throughout the 20th century and into the 21st century. Under Winston Churchill, one of the most enthusiastic executive consumers of intelligence in British history, the power of intelligence transformed the nature of British statecraft, to quote one commentator. In 1968, the role of intelligence coordinator to support the cabinet secretary was created. In the 1980s, the roles of intelligence coordination and foreign policy advisor were effectively joined, which was a task undertaken by a former JIC Joint Intelligence Committee chairman, Percy Craddock. More recently, former Prime Ministers John Major and Tony Blair both did some reorganisation. And then in 2007, Gordon Brown created a National Security, International Relations and Development Committee. So then finally, following a long-standing pledge of the Conservative Party, the 2010 coalition agreement with the Liberal Democrats agreed on the creation of the National Security Committee. So what that shows really is throughout the 20th century and into the 21st century, various UK prime ministers were trying to develop slash improve the way that national security decision making happens in the UK. This presentation will look at the factors which contributed to the creation of the NSC, and then we'll look at whether the NSC has reduced the likelihood of intelligence failures at the hands of executive consumers. I'm more than happy to take questions throughout the presentation. I just need to make sure I'm keeping an eye on the board. So let me know if you have any questions as I go along. Otherwise, I'll take questions at the end. So let's take a look then at why the NSC was created. Sorry, I'm just having a little problem with the slides here. Let me see if I can get them to work. Looks like this slide isn't working, so let's just keep with the military shots. So first of all, let's look at why the NSC was created. My assessment, along with others, is that the Butler review into the misuse of intelligence relating to the invasion of Iraq in 2003 was a major factor in the creation of the NSC. The Butler review was kind of the first review into what went wrong for us in the UK on Iraq. It focused almost entirely on the use of intelligence, so it's really useful to look at what the Butler review said and how that might have impacted the creation of the NSC. For example, the Butler Review talked about a concern for the informality of the way former British Prime Minister Tony Blair's government made policy decisions, which led to reduced capability for informed collective political judgment. I'll come back to the importance of collective political decision making in the UK later, but Butler focused on the informality of Blair's processes. Some people have called Blair's government, for example, a sofa government. The Butler Review also described a decline in the traditional cabinet committee system and its ability to offer objective, independent, and critical advice. Lord Butler, who wrote the review, explained that cabinet committees in the UK are responsible for identifying, testing, and developing policy options, analysing, mitigating risks, and debating and honing proposals until they are endorsed across government. This theme was expanded, I think it was 2016, in the Chilcot report, which was a much wider report into what went wrong in Iraq. In the Chilcot report, it expanded on this principle of cabinet committee system in the UK for decision making. The Chilcot report said that under the UK constitutional conventions, bearing in mind the UK doesn't have an actual written constitution, but the constitutional conventions in the UK, in which the Prime Minister leads the government but is not personally vested with the powers of a head of state, cabinet is the main mechanism by which senior members of the government take collective responsibility for decisions that are of critical importance to the public. What that explains is that in the UK, unlike perhaps the presidential system in the US, in the UK it is the cabinet rather than one person who should be taking the most important national security decisions. In 2011, the coalition agreement itself cited the Butler report as a contributing factor to the creation of the NSC, which is itself a cabinet committee. The lessons learnt from the Iraq debacle also contributed to the way that decisions were made within the NSC, not just to the actual creation of the NSC. For example, David Cameron's biographers, Anthony Seldon and Peter Snowden, have correlated mistakes made during the Iraqi affair with the NSC's subsequent reticence to utilise ground troops in Libya. So Libya was one of the first challenges for the NSC, and there was a reticence to use ground troops, and they've assessed that it was kind of the fallout and the hangover for Iraq that might have contributed to them not doing this. But on the other hand, Cameron also used the legacy of Iraq to support proactive action. For example, telling the House of Commons in December 2015 in relation to the Syrian civil war that this is not 2003. We must not use past mistakes as an excuse for indifference or inaction. In the same parliamentary session, he explained that the NSC had been extensively used for discussions about proposed actions in Syria. This evidence suggests that the fallout from the Iraqi WMD affair went beyond a need to change processes, but also had an impact on the manner in which decisions were made by the executive within the new arrangements. I've just seen Ruben. Thanks for your comments. So you met Lord Butler in Madrid. Excellent. I'd love to discuss this with him, as indeed I would with David Cameron, to see how much it really influenced him. My assessment is that it did, and that it also advised the people around Cameron who advocated the creation of such a council. So coming back to the issue of collegiality, that's also something that I think contributed to the creation of the NSC. So in the UK, we have this concept of collegiality in decision-making, particularly decision-making on national security. For example, in 2009, Mike Goodman at King's, my supervisor for my thesis, wrote about a British way in intelligence, at the centre of which were the notions of collegiality, the drive for consensus, and a committee-style approach to decision-making. So before the creation of the NSC, the centre, really, of UK intelligence coordination was the Joint Intelligence Committee. It uses exactly the same notions of collaboration, collegiality, and consensus. Tony Blair strongly preferred operating in small informal groups rather than through these collegial processes. In stark contrast, David Cameron, who created the NSC, had a collegiate approach to leadership more widely. He believed that the government should take collective decisions on national security rather than a prime minister make unilateral decisions. The NSC enables intelligence to inform policy in a collegiate way at the highest levels. Cameron's personal commitment to decisions being made at the NSC was illustrated when he took a decision to intervene in Libya over the telephone to the NSC from France. So instead of making that decision by himself, he did it using the NSC, using that collegiate forum. I've recently read David Cameron's autobiography, and he constantly refers to decisions being made at the NSC or with the NSC on national security rather than taking advice from NSC. He talks about decisions being made there, which is a reflection really of his approach to leadership. So during the Libya intervention, for example, in 2011, there was considerable time dedicated to collective ministerial discussion, for example, 62 meetings of the NSC on Libya alone. And in general, Cameron encouraged open debate before reaching policy decisions. Furthermore, the NSC hosted very long discussions on other difficult issues, such as what to do about the use of chemical weapons by the Syrian government in 2013, the debate about which would have contained, no doubt, a large amount of intelligence. The National Security Capability Review of last year, which was commissioned by the NSC, stated that it would use the fusion doctrine to improve the collective approach to national security, and also affirmed the role of the NSC as overseer and coordinator of national security as part of collective decision-making, in quotes. So although the Joint Intelligence Committee, before the creation of the NSC, was already a cultivator of the collegiate culture, the NSC has certainly strengthened this approach and ingrained it at the highest level of decision-making on national security in the UK. I'm also going to take a brief moment to talk about whether the UK's NSC was inspired by the US NSC. which is the President's Principal Forum for Considering National Security, as I'm sure you all know, over in the States, and at which sits his national security advisors and US cabinet officials. Of course, unlike the UK's NSC, the US NSC has been around since the late 1940s, and indeed since really the foundation of American Central Intelligence. Like the UK's NSC, the NSC in the US is, of course, chaired by the executive leader, the president. As far as I've read on the US NSC, the US NSC is also tasked with coordinating the national security effort in the US. This isn't really a task officially undertaken at the UK's NSC. It doesn't have a coordination role as such, although it does have a role setting requirements. And that might just be because the UK's culture of collaboration and collegiality on intelligence and security matters is so ingrained in our culture. And that's also a job that was and still is to some extent undertaken at the JIC anyhow. It's important to say that intelligence isn't the only thing used at the NSC. I did mention that in my introduction, but it's important to note that, for example, at the JIC, at the Joint Intelligence Committee, intelligence is mainly used, whereas at the NSC, intelligence will be one of the sources of information used in discussions. So going back to the inspiration from the US, unlike the UK's NSC, the US NSC is a statutory body, and that's something I'm going to talk about a little later. So in the UK, the NSC is not a statutory body, and that does have an impact on whether it has reduced intelligence failures and whether it will reduce them in the future. The United States National Security Council is subject to presidential policy directives setting out how a particular president wishes to employ it. This is a big similarity with the UK system, as I'll also talk about later, because the effectiveness of the UK's NSC is subject to the executive leader, i.e. the Prime Minister and his or her immediate team. So it can be concluded that although there's no evidence that the NSC was modelled on the US NSC, it could have been inspired by it. There are, though, distinguishing features between them, most notably the fact that the US's NSC is a statutory body and the UK's is not. So that's what the NSA is and why the NSC was created. So now I'm going to have a look at whether the existence of the NSC reduces the likelihood of intelligence failures at the hands of UK consumers. So first of all, let's just quickly address the definition within this presentation of intelligence failure. So of course, there's a considerable body of literature about intelligence failures and how they can be prevented, a lot of which comes from the US commentators and academics. Much of this commentary on intelligence failures talks about intelligence failures at the hands of analysts or officers from intelligence. This presentation and the research I've done on the NSC focuses much more on, or almost entirely, on intelligence failures at the hands of those who use it, so it's executive consumers. Richard Betts in 1978 attributed more responsibility for intelligence failures to consumers rather than practitioners, concluding that it's usually impossible to disentangle intelligence failures from policy failures. So if Richard Betts is right, and if the NSC helps to reduce intelligence failures relating to policymakers, then I would conclude that the NSC should, in theory, reduce the likelihood of intelligence failures in the main. Some commentators have argued that the concept of intelligence failure reflects a set of expectations about what intelligence is and what intelligence can do. Most importantly, of course, intelligence is not omniscient. The review into failures of intelligence on Iraqi MD by Lord Butler pointed this out clearly, explaining that the biggest limitation of intelligence is its incompleteness. Understanding the limits of intelligence is a crucial part of the Prime Minister or any senior decision maker's understanding of the nature of intelligence. David Cameron appeared to be well aware of this fact, as illustrated by his comments in 2014 that there are lots of things that the pundits, politicians, and experts have not foreseen in the development of global affairs. This illustrates that David Cameron's understanding of intelligence is that it cannot reliably predict future events. Unfortunately, not everyone understood intelligence as well as Cameron. And one of the biggest problems for this is the fact that a lot of executive intelligence consumers are transitory. For example, members of cabinet. So in the UK, the cabinet members are not there for the lifetime of the prime minister. The cabinet will be subject to what we call a reshuffle, where people come in and out of the cabinet. That means that someone might not be in the cabinet for very long at all. Being in a cabinet post for a short time might make it difficult for that person to really understand the nature and limitations of intelligence and intelligence products. This can lead to a misunderstanding not only of intelligence's incompleteness, but where the products have come from, how they've been put together. So the NSC has had a positive impact on this potential type of intelligence failure, i.e., intelligence failure because of a misunderstanding about the nature of intelligence. So I've just put up here about Michael Handel. So Michael Handel's great book on leaders and intelligence talks about intelligence's role as a tactful educator. At the NSC, intelligence chiefs interact with policymakers directly. This provides a vehicle for intelligence chiefs to explain the nature and limitations of their information. This means that essentially the NSC enables intelligence leaders to explain their products and optimizes the relationship between leaders and intelligence, i.e. the role of tactful educator. So I said earlier on that recently the chief of MI6, SIS, Alex Younger, spoke on a podcast about being able to give his opinion on things, not just to represent his services products. This is true, but he also can go some way at the NSC, just like the other intelligence leaders, to explain, if necessary, the nature of intelligence, the nature of intelligence products, maybe even the nature of language used within intelligence products. So this is a positive aspect for the NSC in relation to this type of intelligence failure. I'd say it's actually a really important positive aspect of the NSC, which is that it gives decision makers regular and formalized opportunity to better understand intelligence, the utility of intelligence, and the limitations of intelligence. And this reduces the risk of intelligence failure through ignorance. On a similar theme, the NSC has achieved one of Bruce Berkowitz's optimizations of the intelligence policy relationship, in which intelligence consumers receive greater insight into the information they receive rather than just receiving written reports. The NSC creates an ideal environment for the Prime Minister to clarify intelligence with intelligence chiefs and in a more transparent way than during the Blair years, i.e. Blair's sofa style of government, where he'd just have intelligence chiefs, not just, but where he'd frequently have intelligence chiefs in his office discussing things on the sofa. However, I should say that as of 2011, which bear in mind was only 1 year after the NSC's creation, but still, a government review recommended that the NSC adopt better processes to enable ministers to understand intelligence and how it is set apart from other reporting, for example, diplomatic reporting. That indicates that in the first year of the NSC, although in theory it helps people within that forum to understand intelligence better, actually, it hadn't achieved it in the first year because the review said that that's still something to work on. So, going back to other types of intelligence failures can also stem from two related issues, which are a lack of challenge within discussions and the effect of psychological pathology, such as groupthink bias. The problems of groupthink usually apply during the analysis and assessment phase of the intelligence cycle, but are also relevant to the use of intelligence by its consumers. For example, psychologist Irving Janis's work in the 1970s concluded that policy-making groups tended to be acutely vulnerable to groupthink. Sir Roderick Braithwaite, who was a former chairman of the JIC, the Joint Intelligence Committee, said in relation to the Iraqi WMD affair that the concept of challenge is an important quality of national security work, However, I have not uncovered evidence to indicate the opportunity for challenge has actually been increased, which is interesting. So within the Butler report and in relation to Iraqi WMD, it said that the JIC had stepped out of its traditional role. It entered into the Prime Minister's magic circle and was engulfed in the atmosphere of excitement which surrounds decision-making in a crisis. As a result, its members went beyond assessment to become part of the process of making and advocating policy. This is groupthink in action and something which the NSC and David Cameron were really aware to avoid once in government. Furthermore, there was a lack of challenge with relation to intelligence assessments on Iraq, and the policy-making community did not challenge the assumptions being put out regarding WMD in Iraq. So John Chilcot's public statement following the publication of his report, a decade later, more than that, in fact, he stressed the importance of collective ministerial discussion, to encourage frank and informed debate and challenge. Evidence suggests, however, that the NSC has not yet mitigated the risk of groupthink. The House of Commons Foreign Affairs Committee, for example, published a report on the Libya intervention, which suggested that the apprehension of Lord Richards with regard to the government's policy was not effectively captured as a challenge within the NSC, i.e., Lord Richards said during the Libya affair that he had was apprehensive about the policy that was being put forward, but that challenge was actually not very well dealt with at the time. Additionally, according to the same Foreign Affairs Committee report, it said that the exclusive nature of the NSC membership limited the possibility of outside challenge in the development of policy on Libya. So what this tells us is that the NSC might not actually have learned all of the lessons from Iraq, and that what happened on Libya echoed some of the problems with groupthink bias and challenge. The government of former Prime Minister Theresa May appears to have taken heed of some of the advice about groupthink and bias. However, there's no actual evidence. There's unfortunately a lack of recent evidence on how Theresa May used the NSC, so we can't conclusively confirm that this type of intelligence failure has been reduced. So the last type of intelligence failure I want to look at in relation to intelligence consumers is stovepiping. This is more of a kind of organisational pathology rather than a problem stemming from the intelligence consumers per se, but it's still an important type of intelligence failure. As Lawrence Peretta noted in his 2012 article about intelligence failures, the organisational failures which led to the 9/11 attacks were dominated by stovepiping of intelligence between US agencies. This led to a misunderstanding of what could be shared, for example. Berkowitz, going back to Bruce Berkowitz, he's also advocated breaking down stovepipes, which inhibit the sharing of intelligence. Now, the UK culturally and traditionally hasn't got a massive problem of stovepiping. The NSC provides a forum of interaction between intelligence chiefs and executive ministers, and interaction between intelligence chiefs and other departmental heads, which is good. For example, Sir David Owen noted that the National Security Strategy of 2010, which accompanied the NSC's creation, would change the use of intelligence from need to know to responsibility to provide. This also fits into Andrew Rathmell's postmodernist analysis of intelligence functions that acknowledges the end of close-knit intelligence communities who keep information close to their chests. However, despite the NSC theoretically reducing stovepiping, there are media reports this year, July 2019, that our former Prime Minister Theresa May and some members of the intelligence community were concerned about previous Foreign Secretary and new Prime Minister Boris Johnson's ability to keep secret information secret, and as a result, limited his access to some secret information. Now, this was just media reporting, and this has been denied. But what this media report showed is that even though Boris Johnson was the Foreign Secretary, which is a very senior post in the UK cabinet, the Prime Minister at the time, Theresa May, she was still able in theory, to stop Boris Johnson seeing some type of intelligence. So that type of stovepiping isn't necessarily about between the agencies, but more between the people from the political side, cabinet members who would be involved in national security discussions. So essentially, the stovepiping of information even within the NSC. As I say, these were just media reports. There's no evidence, and I think both parties denied this, or Johnson at least denied that this had been the case. But it's an example to show that it is still possible. This example also indicates some aspect of Theresa May's personality when it came to controlling information. I know some commentators have said that she was a little bit of a micromanager and a details person. And so this is another indication that the use of the NSC and the use of intelligence by executive consumers in the UK does depend on the personality of the Prime Minister. So I'm going to talk briefly about looking specifically at Iraq versus Libya, Iraq where we didn't have an NSC and Libya where we did, to see if any of the lessons of Iraq had been learned by the time we got to Libya. And therefore, what can we conclude about the utility of the NSC in relation to intelligence failures? Misuse of intelligence relating to Iraqi WND affair is probably the most significant episode of intelligence failure in the UK this century, and beyond this century, to be honest. It's significant not just because of the failures and the subsequent recommendations to emerge from government reviews, but also because this affair brought the use of intelligence by policymakers into mainstream public discourse in the UK. This was because of the way that Tony Blair used intelligence as part of his argument to go to war, but also, as I say, because of the reviews that came out, the public reviews that came out since 2002, 2003. Despite David Cameron, who created the NSC, despite him being opposed to the type of liberal interventionism favoured by Tony Blair, the UK did get involved in the Libya conflict of 2011. And in fact, was a leading member of the kind of Western forces involved in that conflict. As a result, it's useful to consider whether the recommendations from the Butler Review and the Chilcot report into Iraq and other similar reports were adopted by the NSC, and whether evidence from the Libya intervention demonstrates that the NSC system has helped to reduce intelligence failures. The Chilcot report on Iraq concluded that intelligence and assessments were used to prepare material used to support government statements in a way which conveyed certainty without acknowledging the limitations of intelligence. For example, a 2003 report by the House of Commons Foreign Affairs Committee concluded that the assertion that Iraq was sourcing significant amounts of uranium from Africa should have been qualified to reflect the uncertainty of that intelligence. Ultimately, the Foreign Affairs Committee in the UK accused Tony Blair of misrepresenting the status of intelligence. As a result, the UK's Intelligence and Security Committee recommended that in future, intelligence assessment key judgments must reflect the degree of confidence with which they are made and don't rely on the reading of the whole assessment to make this clear. So this is something really about how intelligence in a way is advertised, you know, and the fact that at the time of Iraq, perhaps it wasn't described properly in terms of its certainty. So when the NSC dealt with the Libya conflict, the Libya intervention in 2011, the Chilcot report hadn't been published, but of course the Butler report had been, as had the Foreign Affairs Committee reports. This meant that David Cameron and his colleagues and the NSC as a forum were aware of the types of criticisms levelled at Blair's government and other decision makers at that time on Iraq. Yet, in relation to Libya, the 2016 Foreign Affairs Committee report summarised that the episode, i.e., the interventionism in Libya, was not informed by accurate intelligence. This clearly echoes the Iraqi WND affair. It said this same report from the Foreign Affairs Committee concluded that the Libya intervention was founded on erroneous assumptions and an incomplete understanding of the evidence, which illustrates, of course, that the NSC had not learnt the lessons of Iraq on this point. In terms of the use of intelligence and other information for long-term strategy planning, the Chilcot report on Iraq suggested a more structured process of decision-making pertaining to military invasions might have led to discussions about the wider implications and risks associated with the deployment of military forces. Essentially, there wasn't proper post-conflict planning in relation to Iraq. The same criticisms are levelled at the NSC and David Cameron's team in relation to Libya. David Cameron's biographers, who I talked about earlier, concluded that although the UK's action in Libya was lauded at the time in many quarters, it was accused of failing to anticipate the following destabilisation of the country by Islamic extremists. Now, of course, intelligence isn't to blame for that specifically, but it just shows that the NSC didn't prevent the lack of post-conflict planning that we saw on Iraq. In terms of security decision making, in terms of decision making on national security, Blair, as I've already said, was in the habit of making decisions outside of the cabinet system. Contrary to this on Libya, David Cameron had a totally different approach. During the Libya conflict, as I already said, there were many meetings, I think 62, of the National Security Council on Libya. It functioned as a war cabinet rather than a strategic body. This is something that David Cameron actually says himself, that the National Security Cabinet was a de facto war cabinet on this. Having said this, though, there are other indications to suggest around this time that that decision-making wasn't always made at the NSC. So aside from Libya, for example, the removal of troops from Afghanistan in 2015, former Foreign Secretary William Hague admitted to the Foreign Affairs Committee that the decision on troop withdrawal to remove, the decision to remove troops from Afghanistan wasn't actually made at the NSC, even though at the time people said that it was, or it was reported in the media that it was. Instead, that decision was made by Cameron. In essence, going around the NSC to make such a decision. The Foreign Affairs Committee was surprised by this. The fact that the Foreign Affairs Committee was surprised by this means that the Foreign Affairs Committee expected decisions such as the withdrawal of troops to happen at the NSC, but instead those decisions didn't happen. They happened on were made by Cameron himself as the Prime Minister. So it can be concluded that the formality of national security decision making, including the use of intelligence as part of it, has been improved by the NSC, but the processes can still be bypassed by the Prime Minister. What I should say is that there has been some positive, more positive than probably what I've spoken about in the last 10 minutes, some more positive assessment of the use of intelligence at the NSC. For example, Richard Aldrich and Roy Cormack have concluded that on Libya, the NSC seemed to provide what Tony Blair had never wanted, an objective analysis of the intelligence, a wide range of options, and an open debate about the course of action. So although I give the example of Afghanistan, there was the withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan in 2015. Actually, going back to Libya, Aldrich and Cormack, who wrote a great book, The Black Door, on the use of intelligence by prime ministers in the UK, they've concluded that actually it was much more objective, the analysis of intelligence through the NSC and under David Cameron. Let me just catch up the slides of what we're talking about. I've got too excited. So just to recap on Iraq versus Libya. So as I said, there are still problems with accurate intelligence. Post-conflict planning was a big problem, but there was increased transparency of decision-making. So for example, David Cameron insisted that the minutes of the NSC discussions on Libya were recorded and were also sent round to relevant departments and the relevant readership. This is a direct contrast to what happened under Tony Blair and his government in relation to Iraq. The last point I'll make on this is that the NSC system in the US didn't prevent intelligence failures of Iraq on Iraq. Now, I would say that there are significant differences, of course, as I've already mentioned, between the UK's NSC and the US NSC. However, the fact is that there are some similarities and that the US fell foul of a lot of the same problems on intelligence failure as the UK in relation to Iraq. And so I don't think that you could possibly assess that the UK having an NSC at that time would have meant that the intelligence failures we saw wouldn't have taken place. I mean, of course, you can't prove things in hindsight anyway, but I would say that it's worth bearing in mind that the US's NSC system didn't prevent failures, and we had similar failures across the Atlantic here in the UK. So I know I'm running out of time. I'll just talk briefly about the recent performance of the NSC. So there are two examples, really. One is the use of the NSC in relation to the poisoning of Sergei Skripal well, it's assessed to be by the Russians. So the UK's response to this incident, which happened in 2018, so last year, was holistic in its nature. It was very effective. The response addressed not just piecing together what had happened, but also how to deal with the public health aspect and how to respond internationally. Intelligence will, of course, have heavily featured in the discussions at the NSC about the incident. During this episode, the Prime Minister at the time, Theresa May, was strong in her allocation of blame at the hands of the Russian state. And she stated categorically in Parliament that we are quite clear that Russia was responsible for this act. Now, bear in mind that there had been so much criticism since Iraq about misuse of intelligence and oversimplifying it and not talking about uncertainty or limitations of intelligence. She stated very categorically that Russia was to blame. Which I think is quite significant. It suggests that there wasn't just consensus within the NSC on this issue or on this conclusion, essentially, but that also there was no uncertainty about the intelligence supporting this conclusion. She even clarified in her parliamentary evidence that we have been led by evidence, not by speculation, which I think echoes Tony Blair's use, for example, of intelligence relating to Iraq. The clarity of decision making on this incident led to swift and substantial reaction, partly in coordination with the UK's allies. It included, for example, the expulsion of Russian intelligence officers, it's widely considered to have been an effective response to the incident. The other one to have a quick look at is the use of the NSC in relation to Huawei. And Huawei infrastructure in the UK. A decision was made on this at the NSC, but we've had quite a lot of political turmoil recently in terms of changes of leadership, general election. So essentially, Theresa May handed the final decision, I guess, to Boris Johnson, and then we've had an election, and now it's yet for him to decide again. So we have no final decision on this. But what I would say is that Theresa May appears to have made a decision, or according to the media, made a decision that may not have been in accordance with a lot of senior decision makers at the NSC. For example, some of her most senior ministers have warned that Huawei poses a risk to national security, and apparently some of that stuff was discussed at the NSC. But yet, Theresa May was erring on the side of using Huawei. So we'll see what happens under Boris Johnson. But I think what this shows is that although the NSC is used as the principal forum for discussing national security, in a case like Huawei, it might have been that actually Theresa May overruled ultimately what might have been agreed within the National Security Council. So this really leads us on to coming towards the end of the presentation and concluding, which is that ultimately the personality of the Prime Minister still has an impact on the use of intelligence and therefore the vulnerability of our system to intelligence failures. For example, the National Security Council was more effective when David Cameron was the chair. As we've seen with Huawei, the Prime Minister can use the NSC as they like. So, for example, on Sergei Skripal, it may be that May used the NSC to have substantial discussions and to come to consensus about what action should be taken and how to take the evidence slash intelligence. Whereas on Huawei, some reports suggest that she decided something different than what was agreed at the National Security Council. This is just reporting. There's no real evidence about this yet. But it shows that the impact of the personality of the Prime Minister is significant in the use of the NSC. It should be said that Joe Devanny and Jos Harris have talked about how decision making on national security in the UK does need to work with the Prime Minister's style, And that's something that's important. I think if we had a system that was very rigid, then maybe the Prime Minister just wouldn't use it as they should. So it is an important point to say that it needs to work with the Prime Minister's style. So to conclude, I would say that the NSE is a work in progress. In terms of intelligence failure, there are some improvements. For example, the NSE can act or can facilitate education of intelligence consumers because it's a place where intelligence chiefs meet regularly with intelligence consumers, senior executive intelligence consumers, and they have an opportunity not just to represent their products, but to also give their subject matter expertise, maybe to clarify elements of intelligence that might not be clear to some, and also talk about the limitations of intelligence. But the effectiveness is still at the whim of the Prime Minister. We've also seen evidence that challenge is still not easy within the NSC, and that there's still a risk of groupthink bias. But I think the most important point is that it's not a statutory body, and therefore the effectiveness of the NSC as a place to facilitate the meeting of intelligence and policymakers at the highest level, although it's formalized and regularized, it's the use of this forum is still at the effective still at the whim of the Prime Minister. So that's my final point, really. That's a canter through the why the NSE was created and the impact of it. What I would say is that of course the evidence that we can use about the NSE in the UK is always restricted by the records we have access to. Some of the points I've made in my presentation do come from the media. For example, Boris Johnson maybe being restricted in his intelligence readership by Theresa May. But there are other bits of evidence that we can use to say that in general, the NSE's creation has had a positive effect and it's moving in the right direction. But really, without being a statutory body or without having some formal guidance about how it's used, it's only as good as the person who uses it, i.e. the Prime Minister. So thanks for listening to me, everyone. I'm happy to take questions if there are any.
Thank you for that, Celia. That was really interesting. So in thinking about this as a research project, obviously some questions probably arose along the way that you weren't able to address in the primary project. So with that in mind, what can you tell us about some of the interesting questions that you uncovered but have yet to be able to address with this line of research?
Sure. So I think, you know, in an ideal world, I'd be able to sit in and watch the NSC meetings happen. I think that the biggest problem is, as with intelligence in general, is that we almost hear things sometimes through Chinese, not Chinese whispers, and I know that's probably not the term that's used anymore, but what I mean is that we don't have first-hand access to, for example, the log of the meetings of the NSC on Libya, nor should we, but what it means is that we are always skewed, and I think actually Richard Aldrich has written about this. We're always skewed by what we have access to. So the questions really that I'd have is the important questions I'd have are, how is intelligence used, i.e., is it a major part of what the NSC discusses? Have there been times where the intelligence that's on the table has fundamentally changed a policy decision? Because one of the interesting things I was looking at for my master's was the fact that David Cameron apparently already had some preconceived ideas on Libya or on Colonel Gaddafi. And so was his policy or the government's policy on Libya actually as a result of preconceived ideas rather than something that was decided within that forum? This presentation really just looks at intelligence failures, but I'm really interested in politicization of intelligence as well, and to what extent the NSC kind of enables that politicization. So I guess, Nicole, the answer to your question is I have lots of questions that can't be answered without direct access to what goes on at the NSC.
No, that's fantastic. And that's typically how it goes, especially with
Yeah,
questions
that's
over
it.
being and things of that nature. I see Alice typing, and I'm curious to see if it's going to be a question. So I'm going to just pause here for a moment. If you guys have any questions for Celia, go ahead and put them in the chat right now. From Al Lewis, you mentioned confidence in the assessments. The U.S. has mandated probabilistic language in IC 203 that ties specific language to a percentage for likelihood. Are you using a similar scale?
Yeah, absolutely. So in the UK, we have adopted a similar scale. We took a while to get there. I'm not sure when ICD 203 came in, but I know from my time in government that it was coming in around the time that that I left. I have a feeling that it came from the military before it came into central government. But yes, we are now using such a scale for assessments, which indicates this is the language we use, and this is what that means in terms of percentage of probability. You're welcome, Al.
Well, thank you for joining us today, Celia. I want to be respectful of your time and that of everyone that has been able to join us today. So again, thank you. The meeting was recorded, so I will make sure that I get that recorded, the link out onto our website live in the next couple of days. And we will be sending out additional information on upcoming events like this. And Celia, if you're interested in being included on those, just let me know and I'll make sure that you get those emails as well.
Excellent. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Thank you so much. Have a great rest of your day.
Thanks, you too.